To Want a Boy, Chapter 13. Martha seemed almost disappointed when she found me still at home that evening. I had no intention of racing off half-cocked. I had to cash in the money for the kids, give them some advice on how to handle it, and when I had them all convinced, we transferred both their monies and all of mine to a bank in California. I signed all the properties over into Martha's name alone and cleaned up a lot of loose ends. I did not intend to return to Kansas for a long time. Possibly ever. Then I met Whit and Trixie the next morning for breakfast. They asked me to attend the wedding with them, as a witness, and that's when I got the idea. "Let's let Martha's pastor perform the ceremony," I suggested.
"Wouldn't Mama raise a stink? I just thought you and Tad would come, and Whit's folks."
Trixie's face was pale with worry. "You can't leave Diana out, Trixie," I chided her.
"But she's always been just like Mother, until last night. Well, okay, I guess I should."
Trixie was thinking aloud more than talking to me. I was glad at her change of attitude.
"We have the license and our health check and everything, Bert," Whit said quietly. "We'll wait if you..."
"You don't have to wait, Whit." I got up and went to the phone. Soon we had Tad and Diana with us. Diana's eyes had no more sparkle than I'd ever seen in them. We met Whit's parents in the vestibule of the church, and they were nearly as excited as the kids. "Let me just speak with the pastor alone a few minutes, if you don't mind, kids." And I pushed the minister unceremoniously into his study. We talked, or rather I did. But he was an all right guy and went along with me. Funny how such a human person could preach every Sunday without touching the heart of a person like Martha. The parson phoned her, and as I had anticipated, she did her duty. Within a few minutes, she was parking her car in the parking lot and hurrying up the walk for the wedding. Her hat was pinned firmly to her head. No funny business with Martha. I don't think it ever could have been as wonderful as it had Martha not been invited or had she declined. Her approval was the final ingredient necessary to give Trixie the happy start that got that beautiful wedding that day. A photographer I'd called when I'd called the kids finally arrived in the middle of everything, and he captured the wedding kiss and the happy bride and groom. Yes, and even the happy parents. It was our last act as husband and wife, and it was a wonderful way to end things. Martha even smiled as I helped her into her car.
"Thank you for thinking of Pastor Robbins," she said in a wavery voice.
"It was the only way I could think of to get you here. And we did need you here, Martha," I said honestly.
"Yes, I know," she answered,
keeping the sarcasm I felt hidden and buried. "Goodbye, Martha. I'm leaving from here."
"Goodbye, Bert," she said quietly. I hope you have a good life."
"Thank you," I said, surprised. "Same to you." And I turned and walked quickly away. The weight that was lifted from my shoulders in the short 2 days was impossible for me, even me, to imagine for quite some time. I still had no solution to my dilemma. I decided not to keep going to California. I'd been disappointed there. Now, however, I either had to go east or west, and west certainly seemed the lesser of two evils. My own children had tossed the coin and called the shot. California it would be. I couldn't live in San Diego. It'd be too close to my kids with the life I was contemplating. Better if I were halfway in between Trixie and Diana and Tad. That way, with me on the road a lot, they would have to call before a visit, and I could probably call on them even though they wouldn't care much about visiting me anyway. I laughed as I pulled into the loading dock. Here I was, planning my lewd and lascivious life with a man I had never met and might not ever meet. It was nothing really to be laughing over. All my protests did not alter the fact that Bob was still very much on my mind. I could never respect him, could never trust him, but I still needed him. There was no way to alter that fact. Perhaps he would have tired of his marriage to the producer by now, and at least want another interlude with me. I knew that as soon as I could get to California, I'd at least call him and try. I knew it, but that didn't mean it was easy to accept. I detested the idea of begging him to move in with me. I had as much money as his producer, perhaps more, but I could never be any help to his career. I knew full well that he would never be satisfied with me on that basis for very long. He was born to use people, and there was no hope of changing him. I'd vowed never to see him again after the embarrassment he'd caused me, bringing me in as a substitute, probably his partner. I didn't even like to think of that last meeting. It had been the first time another human had been told of my weakness. It had been unbearably embarrassing. As I thought about it, it seemed different somehow. I'd been through much since then. Somehow, it wasn't nearly so important. And why the hell couldn't I admit, at least to myself, that I was queer? Gay. Homosexual. As I said the words to myself, they came easily for the first time. Wasn't it far better to be homosexual than sexless? Hell, that was far worse. What I thought I was for 40 years than what I'd turned out to be. With an almost giddy head, I marched into the dispatcher and asked if there were any runs to L.A. I was loaded and on my way in less than 2 hours. Now the miles couldn't flash by fast enough. I passed the hill where I'd picked up Bob, stopped for coffee at the place I'd planned to dump him and didn't, then the place I'd finally pulled over to succumb to his caresses. My rod pounded as I thought about it. I didn't stop at the motel where we had stayed. I was in too big a rush to get there. I kept telling myself that I might not be able to see him, but my heart rejected that thought completely. Somehow, I would see him. I pulled in, finally, to the phone booth where I always called. I dialed the number and waited. It seemed to ring forever. Then the operator's voice came on the line and said that the number was no longer in service. Sick, I hung up the receiver. I stood there not knowing what to do. I had to think of something. I'd expected someone other than Bob to answer the phone, someone who would at least know where I could reach him. Then I remembered the number in my wallet. I reached in and fumbled for the card. Then I dialed the number. Hello, Carl's voice came on the line. Is this Carl Rheingold, I asked. Yes, he answered. I'm trying to get in touch with Bob Archer. Could you tell me where I might contact him? I wouldn't have the slightest idea, he answered, and a voice suddenly turned cold. There was a pause. I couldn't just hang up. It was my only chance to find Bob. Then he spoke again, his voice hesitant and questioning. Is this Bert Schrader by any chance? Yes, I answered. Yes, it is. Where are you? He asked. Just at a phone booth. Listen, I have to speak to Bob. Don't you really know where I could find him? No, Bert. I haven't seen or heard from him since the day we came to see you. What was the name of the man he moved in with? I was grasping for straws now. He never told me, Bert, he answered sympathetically. Okay. Thanks a lot. And I hung up before he could say anything more. All the way into the warehouse, I thought up and discarded one idea after another. By the time I pulled in and backed up to the ramp, I knew that there was no sensible idea possible. I resigned myself to it, but I was miserable with the finality and reality that had just burst my beautiful dream. I wondered idly whether Evan had found his dream. And did it turn out to be Carl? I cut the engine, gathered up my clipboard and paperwork, and opened the door. As I jumped down, I find myself towering over the immaculately tailored man with the graying temples. Bert? He asked hesitantly. Yes, Carl, I answered. When you finish with your business, my car is parked right over there. I'd like to talk to you, he said quietly. All right, I said, and I walked quickly away. I wondered what he was selling, or perhaps wanting to buy. He was the kind of man who could put you at your ease instantly. He must be selling. Yet he was in no way effeminate. His clothes were British and cut, expensively tailored, but not overdone. He wore them with a casual ease that even Evan would have envied. He wasn't really a handsome man, at least not what you'd call pretty. His hair was black and well-groomed, combed back at the sides and then down at the back. His voice especially moved me. It was soft and low and cultured without being pushy, and his openness was immediately apparent when he spoke. The sprinkling of white hair at the edge of his temples made me guess his age at about my own, though he could certainly have been a good 10 years younger. All these impressions flitted across my mind as I signed in and did my paperwork. I had absolutely no intention of leaving the parking lot with this guy, but his pitch interested me. Why had he whipped all the way over here? I was definitely not interested in any side affairs right now, but it just might be that Carl could lead me to Bob after all. Then the least I could do was talk to the guy. 10 minutes. What would that hurt? But when the dispatcher asked if I was ready to sign on another load, I told him I'd let him know later. Then I finished up and went to the can and washed up as best as I could. I looked at the mirror and wondered which one of us was lying to who, my reflection or me. Well, hell, I said aloud to my image, he's the only lead I have to Bob. That slob in the mirror thumbed his nose. Go to hell, I told him, and walked out onto his car. It was a black XKE. He leaned over in the seat and opened the door as I walked up. I had one hell of a time trying to climb in. This car was not built for a man of my dimensions. I felt awkward as a bear cub as big as a damned house. Finally, I lowered my frame into the surprisingly comfortable seat. This car was obviously not built for me. I tried to laugh, but it was a strain. He smiled, but his face quickly returned to a serious frown. "Is there any place around here where we could have a cup of coffee?" he asked. "Sure, just up the block," I said as he started the engine. I nodded approval. "It has a good sound." "Thanks," he grinned. "I spend entirely too much time tinkering with it, I'm afraid. Bob told me once that the Kenworth was yours. I'd like to look under that hood sometime." He'd hit my soft spot. Any man who can appreciate the quality of my truck can't be all bad. I eased back further in the seat and relaxed almost too much. "Hey, there's the place," I said, sitting up with a jerk. He wheeled that little toy car in so fast it was unbelievable. Then he grinned. "It doesn't haul much, but it can turn a corner." With that, we both laughed. "There's a trick to getting out of this thing. Let me show you," he said as he opened the door. He made it look easy. I followed his instructions, and it was a lot easier than I thought. We went in and took a booth. He continued to make small talk until the waitress put the cups in front of us and left. Then he stared at his cup so long I finally asked him point blank, "Tell me, Carl, what do you have in your mind? What was on Bob's mind when he brought you out? And while I'm at it, are you buying or selling?" His head jerked up, shocked. Then he saw the honest disgust and near anger spread across my map, and he smiled. "Neither, Bert. I intend eventually to tell you all about myself, and I would like to know all about you. I'm quite sure Bob brought us together that day so he could keep track of both of us and reclaim us whenever the mood struck him. I was one of his customers. I hope by the time he decides to reclaim us, we will neither want or need him." He watched me closely as he spoke, and I him. "I know what you don't want. I'm not certain I know what you do want of me. I never heard of you before that day." He smiled. "I would imagine not. You are not, after all, a customer. However, I did hear much about you, and all of it good." I leaned back in the booth and eyed him cynically. I'm pretty sure that was what it talked about. He made that abundantly clear the day we met. Carl nodded his head and smiled. He leaned back then, too, and half-closed his eyes as he remembered things Bob had said. "Oh, yes." He dwelt on that at great length. Then he leaned forward and said earnestly, "But that isn't what piqued my curiosity about you or brought me out here to meet you." "No," I said. "Then what did?" And I leaned forward and propped my chin on my hand, waiting for his reply. He sat there, seeming to search his mind for a long time. Finally, he said, "Bob told me how you had met. How he seduced you, if you'll excuse me," he added when I grimaced. "He used to call you his innocent in a derogatory way, but I sensed from the first time that Bob was mistaken about you in more ways than one." "And how'd you arrive at this amazing conclusion?" I asked, and there was no hiding my sarcasm now. He saw that I was becoming thoroughly upset, and his voice became almost aggressive in its earnestness. "First, he thought of you as an interesting hayseed that drives a truck, his poor country cousin. He could see that that hurt, and he meant it to hurt. But he went on hurriedly. You can't be poor and pay cash for a Kenworth, now can you, Bert? And no hayseed ever accumulated that kind of money. All right, that's point one. Then he thought it was hysterical that you took 40 years to find out about what you wanted. But I could never laugh about that, because I was 35 before I took that route myself. Perhaps it's just to save my own conscience, but I feel that any man who tries his damnedest to live the other way for 35 or 40 years before he gives in to his needs is a pretty moral, decent fellow. And that, Bert, is when I started my campaign to get introduced to you. Yes, I frankly tried everything in the book to get that introduction." The sarcasm had dissolved, and I was left defenseless. Were you ever married? I asked. He nodded. Yes, I have children, too. We have a lot in common, you and I. I feel so damned ridiculous having you know me like a book when I never even heard of you. There's plenty of time for that, Bert. I would like to propose something. I'd like you to come out to my house. I'd like to have you spend a couple of days with me, just getting acquainted. I don't want any temporary weekend. I understand, I interrupted, his hesitant attempt to set me straight. Neither do I. Good. Will you come with me now, Bert? He asked quietly. Yes, I'd like that, I answered, and a tremor stabbed through my entire body. I've got to get back for my gear, I said as we worked our way out of the booth. I took the check from him, dropped a tip for the waitress, and handed the cashier the correct change. Then we went back to the loading yard. "Where is your gear?" he asked. "I'll get it for you." I was still so clumsy at getting in and out of his toy car that I let him go do it. Behind the driver's seat, I grinned and shrugged my shoulders in a gesture of helplessness. My truck was almost as big for him as his car was small for me. Finally, he found my ditty bag and suitcase and scrambled back down out of the cab. He grabbed the bottom of the door with both hands and slammed it shut. He stowed my gear through the back window, and when he climbed in beside me, he was all out of breath. "Then you think you have problems," he muttered as he started the car. We drove for some time. I paid no attention except when he'd point out something specific, but soon we were climbing up out of the flat monotony of the Los Angeles terrain. Eucalyptus raced lazy branches skyward, and the lazy cocoa camosa palms drooped their unpatterned fronds carelessly this way and that. A breeze stirred, sending chilled shivers along the branches and leaves. Far back in the lush growth, small patches of huge homes stirred the imagination. This was rich man's country, an area where men not only made big money, but had the taste and imagination to know how to spend it well. A pang stabbed at me as I thought of the house I'd lived in for so many years. My children would never know the joy and pride of living in a house they could really be proud of. I hoped then that the start I'd given them and the help I would be able to add later would give their lives more color and beauty than they'd known in their early years. Then Carl wheeled the sleek sports car into a long, palm-lined driveway that curved around to the front of a gigantic stone mansion. "It's beautiful," I whispered. "Yes," he answered, but then there was no bravado in his voice. "Isn't it? It once belonged to a movie star, back when they had to make a really big show." I turned to look at him. He was leaning over, peering out the windshield, up at the Tudor lines of his own home. He seemed to be in as much awe of it as I was. Then he looked over and our eyes met. He smiled. "I guess I'll never get over owning it." "No, I wouldn't either." We opened the car doors and climbed out. Or rather, he climbed out and I struggled out. I really stretched out when I got out of the confinement of that machine. He stood watching me admiringly. "You're a giant," he laughed when I'd hit my full expanded stance. I shrugged. "It was too much of all that good farm living," I explained, and together we walked up the path toward the huge double doors that led into his house. I had no way of knowing it then, but I was walking into far more than just a house.